Right. Hello, hello. I apologize. I wasn't here for sitting. My husband John works for the All Classical radio station, and if any of you listen to that, you know they're on their membership drive. So he works different hours, and I need to go pick him up. Yeah, all righty. I will go around and say hello to Linda C. Right? C? No. I always forget. Tell me where you are again, Linda, and then I can just say Linda from.
Oh, from Portland.
Oh no, that doesn't help.
it's R for Ronstadt.
R.
Oh, okay. I did see her in concert once.
So it's Linda R?
Yes.
Okay. All right then. Linda R, Franklin, Bob, Susan, Paul, Sam. And Sam, can you tell us what kind of owls those are? Do you know?
Northern Saw-Wet.
Aw. Tyler, Marv, Jim, Bridget, Jeff, Karen, John, Gathel, Shoketsu, Joan, Kate, Sabrina, Jinryu, Amanda, Drew, Janice, welcome, Grant, and Ruth Ann. All right. Okay, so as usual, I can't think of any particular announcements. I guess I can say that we have two new board members. They aren't here tonight, but the other Linda and James Gregg, and we will, yes, thank you. And we have a board meeting in April, and at that meeting we'll definitely be discussing, I don't know what the timeline is in terms of, you know, I'm not willing to go back to the Zendo until like everyone's vaccinated who's willing to be vaccinated, and cases and hospitalizations and everything have just really, really gone down. It's not just like hanging out with a bunch of people you know, right? It's a public space. You don't know who's going to walk through the door and whether they've been vaccinated. So, and our space isn't that big and doesn't have the greatest ventilation. So anyway, it's not, you know, it's still out of ways. I can't imagine anything before like July. But, you know, it could be on the horizon, in which case we'll be having to think about how we, you know, how we get the gear in order to be able to have people, you know, participate by Zoom in-person things. And, you know, we'll have to be thinking about, I don't know, what's the future of the Sangha? What does it look like? How do we keep people feeling like they really belong? You know, not creating too much of a division between a sense of like the remote people and the local people. And probably there's going to be a demand for Zoom only things, you know, things that are just done online, and a demand for a few things that are done just in person. So stay tuned. If you have any ideas or experience or whatever, you're welcome to let me know. We can talk about it. But just know that the Zen Center leadership will be thinking about these things. And we are, for anybody who is joining us remotely and hasn't heard this before, we are committed to, you know, maintaining a Sangha for those of you who are at a distance. So just know that. Okay. So tonight's class, this is the fifth in the Foundational Teachings series. I believe April 13th, the precept classes begin, and those will be led by senior students who have received the precepts and been practicing with them for a number of years. So that's always a treat. Is just, and then every class is led by somebody else. It's a different kind of flavor. It's I look forward to it myself. So this is the fifth Foundational Teachings class, and it's on mindfulness. So mindfulness, I will get around to our Zen definition of that. But essentially, I consider mindfulness to basically be our basic practice whenever we're not on the meditation seat. That our aspiration is to be mindful at all times. I mean, we try not to be too hard on ourselves, right? If we get a little distracted or we watch a movie or something like that. But that basically mindfulness, awareness of what is going on, is our aspiration. But so I want to talk, we're going to be talking tonight about what is mindfulness, what is mindfulness practice, what does it look like? Now, part of the point of this class series, this foundational class series, is to familiarize you with the traditional Buddhist teachings. And by that, I mean kind of the original teachings of the Buddha. And I've used the analogy before of a, or I guess it's a metaphor. I never know if it's a metaphor or an analogy of a tree. I guess it's a metaphor with a trunk, and that's the original teachings. And then it branches, and there's Mahayana and Theravada and these different branches. And then even within them, there's different lineages. So over time, Buddhism has gotten more diverse in terms of its teachings and practices. But so this is in part to familiarize you with that trunk. You know, what are the teachings that this arose from? And almost all of them, like, we have our own Zen way of approaching these particular aspects of the teaching. And this is definitely true in the case of mindfulness. So I'm going to talk about the Buddha's teachings on mindfulness, but it's not important for you to remember all the details. If you're interested, if you find it intriguing and you want to learn more, then there's certainly, you know, might have podcast episodes on it. There's more you can explore, but mostly this is just to give you exposure to it, remind you of it. And sometimes, you know, the teachings, they might give you perspective. I think it's good if you identify with this tradition at all to know a little bit about its history. And sometimes you encounter new aspects of the teaching or new teachings that are actually helpful. So I'll give a very brief overview of the Buddha's teachings on mindfulness and then discuss how the same teachings and practices manifest in Zen. And this is going to be really quick. I'm going to be trying to go as fast as I can in order to give a little bit more time for breakouts tonight, because I feel like they're always kind of getting short shrift. So hopefully I'm aiming for 8:30. We'll see, so that we can have a decent size breakout to talk about, you know, what, if you want to share what your mindfulness practice looks like, or if you prefer to be less personal, you know, what is mindfulness practice? Or if you're somebody who's brand new to this and you're like, I don't know what mindfulness practice is, speaking to what, do you have an impression of what mindfulness is based on what you've heard or read, especially in popular culture now, right? Because it's being talked about in more and wider context. You know, you shop at a natural foods grocery store, there's now a magazine called Mindful. So if you were to, so we've already talked about the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. I wish we had had another class to spend on the Eightfold Path, but if you were to ask the Buddha the question of how to walk this path of practice that he laid out, there would be basically two aspects to it. There would be ethical behavior, because if you're making a mess of your life, it's very difficult to concentrate on spiritual practice. So ethical behavior plus mindfulness. So mindfulness is like, time after time in the Pali Canon, the Buddha is asked, how do you practice? And he says, well, let me describe mindfulness. So there's a very, very central teaching of the Buddha. And it's not that easy to separate it from meditation. How is mindfulness different from meditation? And I will get to that. But those are two aspects of the Eightfold Path, right mindfulness, or appropriate, correct mindfulness, and right meditation or concentration. So mindfulness is a translation of the term sati, which means to remember or keep in mind. So my favorite Theravadan Buddhist scholar, Tenisiro Bhikkhu, uses the analogy of, if you are you're on a trip to a mountain, mindfulness is keeping your eye on the road and some sense of, you know, keeping your eye on the mountain. Are you headed toward the mountain? Are you still on the road? That's like mindfulness, remembering to watch the road. My analogy is binoculars. So if you have binoculars and, you know, there's a bird, there's some movement in the bush outside your house and you want to see what's in it, right? You put your binoculars there, and mindfulness is like keeping the binoculars on the bird. And, you know, you can, that sounds easy, right? But basically after about 10, 20 seconds or so, you know, whatever, you might be looking at something else. Maybe you put the binoculars down, whatever. This is kind of like a description of the way that our mind usually works, right? We don't really keep, even we've chosen what we want to pay attention to. And yet we aim our binoculars all over the place. So mindfulness is bringing the binoculars back and keeping them there as long as we can. So I like how the centrality of mindfulness in Buddhism basically acknowledges our tendency to forget and get distracted. The very fact that it's important to remember and to try to keep your mind where you want it to be says, well, that's not necessarily that easy, right? That's something we actually have to work at. So the original and Theravadan perspective of some forms of Buddhism really is that our minds are unruly and they need to be diligently trained. So it's just, I guess, you know, like a horse, and if you want to ride it, you got to do all kinds of work with it and train it so that it obeys. And the analogy, to use a different animal, is that of a wild elephant. So I don't know if this is really true, but this is the analogy, that apparently if you want to tame a wild elephant, you capture it, which is not that easy to begin with, right? But that's not part of the analogy. You tie it to a stake. You tie one of its feet, you chain one of its feet to a stake. So it tries to get away, but it can't, and it has to come back to the stake. And eventually it gives up and then is able to be tamed. And eventually you have an elephant that all you have to do is just put a little tiny rope around its leg, its foot, and tie it to the stake, and it will stay. So it's not actually being physically held there. So again, I don't know if that analogy is true, but that is the vision of original Buddhism. It's that our minds are by nature very unruly and undisciplined, and don't tend to focus, don't tend to pay attention to what we should, and they need to be trained, and they can be trained, is the idea. So mindfulness in original Buddhism, excuse me, mindfulness is very purposeful. in the Buddhist context. Now, modern secular mindfulness is about, you know, cultivating a non-judgmental, very open awareness of, and maybe of your breath, maybe of, I don't know, various other meditative objects, but it's very, or maybe it's just, you know, going about your day, very open, non-judgmental awareness, particularly of the breath or body. And these are aspects of the Buddhist practice of mindfulness, but just a couple of them. Because right in, and then again, I'm not saying that this is necessarily like the Zen version of teaching, but this is the original teaching. So right mindfulness, meaning appropriate, correct, the kind of mindfulness that is going to be fruitful on the path, is mindfulness of particular things. It's not just mind blank open mindfulness of anything. It's mindfulness of particular things. So that would be like, if you're on that road, it's mindfulness of the road. It's not mindfulness of the beautiful autumn leaves. It's not mindfulness of that other road that you might take. It's not, it's mindfulness of what is going to get you where you're going. So there were four, what the Buddha called the four foundations of mindfulness. So these are the things that you should cultivate mindfulness of, that you should pay attention to, keep the mind trained on, remember to take as your object, and then, you know, remember to bring the mind back to them. So this is directly from the Pali Canon. The Buddha says, "This is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the overcoming of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and distress, for the attainment of the right method, and for the realization of unbinding or nirvana." In other words, the four establishings of mindfulness. Which four? There is the case where a monk remains focused on the body in and of itself, ardent, alert, and mindful, subduing greed and distress with reference to the world. He remains focused on feelings, ardent, alert, feelings in and of themselves, ardent, alert, mindful, etc. He remains focused on mind, and he remains focused on mental qualities in and of themselves, ardent, alert, and mindful, subduing greed and distress with reference to the world. So those four are the body, feelings, mind, and then mental qualities is a weird way to put it. I think of it as like, well, we'll get to what it means, but the Dharma almost. So in terms of body, this is what, you know, like secular mindfulness tends to focus on mindfulness of the body. And it's mindfulness notably in and of itself. So this is a difficult thing to describe, right? Because it's such a subjective thing, but it's mindfulness of the body. It's awareness of the body with the body. So it's not like, you know, kind of a mental, intellectual awareness of my hand. I'm not thinking about my hand. I am feeling the hand with the hand. So it's a very, it's difficult to describe, right? But it's an embodied mindfulness. And then there's mindfulness of the breath. There's all kinds of practices within mindfulness of the body. So there's even a whole sutra just on mindfulness of the breath, mindfulness of the in-breath being short, mindfulness of the out-breath being short, mindfulness of the in-breath being long, mindfulness of the out-breath being long, various things like that. So you're building you're strengthening your mindfulness and training it on the body. Then you are mindful, then I mean, there is an arc of practice here. It's easiest to start with the body because that's the thing that's least likely to stimulate our thinking. But then you move on to mindfulness of the feelings, and feelings in the Buddhist sense are not complex emotions. Feelings are basically pleasure, pain, neutral, like, dislike, indifference. So it's just the very basic, like, ooh, or yeah, or eh, you know. So that's so we become mindful at each moment of whether we're feeling attraction or aversion or indifference, and becoming very intimate with those feelings. Then there's mindfulness of mind, and it's kind of like mind states, or, and particularly it highlights the presence or absence in the mind of greed, aversion, and or delusion, and discerning whether the mind is, and there's very specific definitions of all of these, which I cover a little bit in my podcast, enlarged, surpassed, concentrated, or released. So there's all different kinds of mind states. If you have a kind of a limited, constrained mind state versus kind of a calm and open mind state, and becoming aware of that. And the secular mindfulness is correct in emphasizing that non-judgmental quality. In this mindfulness practice, we're not analyzing it or judging it or even trying to change it at this point. We are just becoming aware. Aversion is arising. You know, so. And then the fourth establishing of mindfulness has a list here. So there's the presence or absence of the five hindrances within you: sensual desire, ill will, sloth, restlessness, and doubt. Presence or absence. And then the ephemeral, not self nature of the five aggregates of which you are composed: your body, sensations, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. There's the presence or absence of the seven factors of awakening. So that's mindfulness of mindfulness, analysis of qualities, persistence, rapture, calm, concentration, and equanimity. And like I said, just let it wash over you. You don't need to remember all the details. If you are curious, there's more stuff about all of this and what each of these means. And then mindfulness of the Four Noble Truths. So what we're talking about is the mindfulness of the presence of dukkha, of that dissatisfactoriness, of that resistance. Mindfulness, paying attention, keep, you know, we got your binoculars on and you're watching. All right. And notice some dukkha. What's with that? And we cultivate the ability to keep our eyes on it long enough to see what happens, it's like we're becoming scientists observing our own mind. So we're learning how to observe what happens in our own mind and body, and kind of do it in an objective way. I noticed when I thought this, then I felt dukkha. And then when I didn't think that dukkha didn't arise. So it's, you're learning about your own mind. So seeing what causes dukkha to arise, recognizing how it ends, and then mindfulness of the path of practice. So like I said before, it's like this interpenetrating kaleidoscope of Dharma, right? You got the Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, right? Mindfulness is on the Eightfold Path, and right mindfulness involves mindfulness of the Four Noble Truths. So in Theravada and modern Vipassana, I mean, it certainly differs by lineage, teacher, school, but generally speaking, relative to Zen, they are quite systematic about this. You know, that they really do. I wasn't sure, so I talked to some Theravadan practitioners. Like, you really might go at a retreat where, okay, first of all, we're going to start with mindfulness of the body, and then we're going to move to mindfulness of feelings, or, you know, mindfulness of some aspect of the Dharma or something like that. So there's real, it is systematic if you're more than a casual practitioner. So, and the goal is really to, you know, is liberation, is seeing the true non-self impermanent nature of everything, including all of these things, and seeing how the Dharma operates, seeing how the Four Noble Truths operate, discovering for yourself the efficacy of the path. So just a brief thing in terms of meditation versus mindfulness. So meditation is like deeper states of, you know, calmness of mind or concentration, which are unusual. It's not just like, so we need some of that, right? In order to cultivate mindfulness, you need a little bit. But I said, mindfulness would be like keeping your binoculars right, you know, there, in aimed at the right thing. And concentration might be like really, you know, really watching carefully, learning how to, you know, focus in on what's going on. So they're complementary, but they're not exactly the same thing. So Aya Kema is a Theravada nun, and she explains how deep tranquility in meditation is, quote, the underlying factor needed for profound insights, which can change an ordinary worldling to a noble one, which is the goal of our practice, end quote. And she describes how the critical insights that result in spiritual liberation occur as a result of a calm, clear mind, rather than from discursive thinking or analysis. When our minds are truly calm and stable, we can use them for concentrated investigation, which will reveal the deepest truths of Buddhism to us and allow us to relinquish our grasping after things that cause suffering. So you need right mindfulness and right meditation, basically, in the original teachings. So you learn a lot through this mindfulness, this cultivation of mindfulness, which is, you're probably going to be doing a bunch of it in meditation. So it's not separate from meditation, but the meditative states are basically, is what they describe it, is like, you know, if you're using these, the various aspects of mindfulness, like you have a meditative object, even if the meditative object is dukkha, right? That eventually, if your mind gets calm enough, you don't need a meditative object anymore. So I guess that means like you don't have to tie the elephant to the stake anymore. And then you can, you know, settle in and investigate even these deeper things. So that's a very, very quick overview of the traditional view of mindfulness. So let me briefly mention how we hold it in Zen, and then we can go into our breakout rooms. So, you know, Zen is like very, you know, it's a lot of evolution from this teaching to Zen. So we take all, we treat all of this in a very different way, but I would argue that it's all there. That there's nothing in this that is incompatible with Zen or that we've thrown out. We just approach it in a different way. So, and this is particularly, I'm speaking particularly of Soto Zen and Shikantaza, you know, themeless meditation. Because you might say, you could say perhaps that koans and Rinzai Zen are, I don't know. You might say that they're a little bit similar to these objects of mindfulness. Not quite, but whatever. Like you have an object of meditation and it's meant to bring you further in your investigation of the Dharma. But we're just sitting. So what is that about? So it's I would say it's a different view of human nature. That in the Mahayana traditions, we believe, but I feel like we intuit that we experience that we really, for us, our true natures are enlightened or are pure or are untroubled. It's our own mind, it's our own grasping and delusions that cloud that. And that So we have this emphasis on letting go. Like, we are getting in our own way. We are putting the clouds in the sky so we can't see the sun, right? And if we just learn how to, which is not that easy, right? I mean, it's not that it's necessarily an easier way. It's just one that resonates more with some of us. So this emphasis on letting go and allowing our true nature to manifest. I think of this as like sitting quietly in the forest, choosing the right spot in the forest, sitting quietly until the elephant gets used to you. And then the elephant gets curious and the elephant comes over and takes a peanut, you know, that like you're taming the elephant, but in a very different way. And then the elephant becomes convinced you're trustworthy and that maybe you have her best interests in mind. So our pathway to meditative concentration and samadhi is different, but the goal is the same in a way. We still want to explore all of these aspects of the Dharma. We still want to at times be able to let our mind become calm enough and clear enough that we can see more clearly. We just go about it a different way. And so in terms of the mindfulness, you know, we're just not as systematic. So if there's any of you who are like, God, I love a really systematic practice. Hey, go explore Theravada, go explore Vipassana, you know? I mean, that if Zen is frustrating, but we're not systematic about it. And yet, you know, we're also trying to be mindful all the time and mindful of everything that happens in our lives and then trying to learn how to see that through the lens of the Dharma. So I feel like we're trying to explore all of these things, but kind of, you know, however life throws them at us and as we go. So with that, I'm only like 3 minutes late. I wanted to give people a chance to talk about like what, yeah. So how do you describe your mindfulness practice? Because I think it's such an elusive term. I feel like even for myself, I'm not even, sometimes I think I know what it is and I do a podcast on it and I'm like, I don't know, you know. So it's a kind of elusive thing and yet I think very, very important. So how would you describe your mindfulness practice? Or if you don't want to have it be kind of a personal, you know, revelation kind of thing, you know, more generally, how do you think of mindfulness practice? Or if you're, like I said, if you're new to it and you aren't really sure what it is and you don't want to speak to that, then, you know, do you have an impression of it just from what you've read or from what you've heard, or maybe you've taken mindfulness-based stress reduction or something? And then when we come back, share out a little bit, and then I don't know, hopefully there'll be some questions and we can really explore this. So let me recreate the rooms and there we go. I invite you. Right. Hello. I always take it as a good sign when nobody leaves after the breakout rooms. So we have 13 minutes left. So how about we just open it up? And if there are any questions about mindfulness or any aspect of it that people want to discuss, let's do it. And go ahead and either unmute yourself or you can do the raise your hand. Down at the bottom of your screen, there should be a reactions and you can raise your little electronic hand. Or you can write a chat too. If you want to put your name in the chat, you could say you want to say something. Joan.
Well, I have this question. I don't even know if I'm going to be able to put it into words, but it's bugged me for a long time. And, you know, it's kind of like, can you, you know, be mindful and live this life and not miss it at the same time? I mean, because it seems like, you know, like doing Zazen, you're sitting on the cushion, you're really not engaging with like everything else that's going on, right? So you're kind of withdrawn from stuff. And you know, it'd be great to just sit there all the time, but I mean, then you're missing. I don't know. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think so. Well, for me, this is like, because I definitely struggled with, you know, I have podcasts on this, I've struggled with mindfulness, and because I thought, you know, what is it? Is it like, so I'm always like aware of my hands or something? Like I had a very limited idea of like, it means not thinking, and it means like just like aware of my immediate physical surroundings, which is it feels like that takes some very special effort. And it felt like, it kind of felt like the meditation effort, right? Like I kind of need to exclude stuff and be in a special state of mind in order to be mindful in this way. Like it felt special. Like if I'm going to be mindful in the grocery store, you know, what does that mean? Like I'm going to be just like concentrating on my cart and I'm not going to like think about the different prices or notice when people come. I don't know. I mean, I think it's actually worth wrestling with this question for ourselves. Like, well, you know, what does it mean to be alert and aware for my life? I guess for me it feels like, and this is like taking the total like zen approach, it feels like being undivided. So in that sense, I could be engaged in anything. I could be engaged in a conversation or driving my car or playing my accordion or working on a spreadsheet. And if to me, it feels like the mindfulness we're looking for is undivided in the sense that I'm not doing that task and kind of thinking about something else or wishing I was somewhere else, or, you know, kind of dividing from my own experience. So in that sense, I feel like the mindfulness that I'm looking for is more full engagement, but not necessarily in our habitual way, which means we're just kind of grasping after what we want and pushing away what we don't want and having a running commentary on everything. I don't know.
Well, the undivided idea I really like. I think I'm going to wrestle with this for a while. It's just really, I don't know how to think about it or have it make sense to me.
Because we know we should do something, right? We know, like, just our habitual, we don't want to just continue with our habitual mode. We want to do something. We want to be more awake, more attentive, to really look more deeply at our life, you know, to notice, like, you know, the arising, like we notice our mind states, we notice the feelings arising rather than being oblivious to them or like being driven, you know, controlled by them. Mm-hmm. So we know we got to do something.
Yeah.
So what is it?
Thank you.
So I don't know what order other folks raised their hand. Was it Franklin first? I'm guessing that kind of showed up. I don't know. Go ahead, Franklin.
Okay. Yeah. I tried to lower my hand and I unmuted instead. That's okay. I probably wasn't first, but I'll go ahead. So for me, a lot of it, I guess I take kind of a secular view of some of this. And that is, I think of it in terms of the observer part of me and strengthening that as much as possible. And I guess, you know, I guess the observer part of me can be in different modes. And one is just being present and, maybe even just mundane tasks. But I think where it's really useful is in terms of emotional awareness, at least for me. And that's probably where the secular psychological part comes in. And, you know, Pema, I think it's Pema Chodron talks about being hooked, you know? And I like that a lot. That's always stuck with me. And to the extent that I can observe those emotions as they begin to arise, generally I can keep myself out of trouble. Not always. So that's kind of how I think about these days. And I'm sure it's very shallow, but that's kind of it for me now. So thanks.
You remind me of what Kyogen used to say, like, as soon as you become aware of something, of your own thoughts or feelings, whatever, particularly, you're no longer caught in them, not entirely. I mean, you've created some space, and then the other things are possible when we do that.
Yeah, and for me, I've noticed improvements in some of my relationships, especially with difficult children. Yeah.
All right, Tyler.
So I guess I was just recently, I started rereading How to Cook Your Life. And in kind of the opening chapters, they talk about, you know, when you're washing the rice, just wash the rice. When you're doing, and they break down the word sheik and taza into, you know, into sheik, right, shikan, and then taza. So there's just sitting, but then there's like this word of shikan, which is like just to do the thing, whatever the taza part is. It's like, just do that thing. And that kind of struck me, because I guess I'd underlined it when I read it the first time, but I guess then totally forgot about it. So I thought that was sort of how I, you know, I started trying to, when I was doing the dishes, I stopped doing the dishes and reading the news and listening to music and doing six things. I'm like, okay, I'm just gonna do the dishes, right? Like, and it's been like this sort of, that's been like the formal practice of it for me, of trying to find these moments of being like, I'm not gonna multitask. I'm not gonna use this moment to complete six different things. I'll just do that. And then quickly, I was kind of also, I was in the beehive with some kids today, and we were trying to find the queen. And that is trying to find in a beehive, it's a small one, but say there's a couple thousand bees. You're trying to locate one bee that looks a little bit different, that's surrounded by thousands of bees while you're being swarmed around. And the more you get like upset, or like if you get stressed, the more the bees can sense it. The bees get more stressed and it becomes this like really like, but if everyone takes a deep breath and just focuses on looking at this mass of moving bees, someone goes, there it is, there she is, we found her. And it was this sort of like, it was a really, just made me think of it now that we're talking about it, of sort of getting mindful and what it can do. And then all the other bees calm down when you calm down too. So it's, wow. Yeah, it's really interesting.
That's really cool. Yeah. That's an awesome example story. Yeah. I mean, for myself, I've noticed recently, I talked about gratitude on Sunday, and I'm noticing that practice is helping me be what I would call more mindful. Because the mindfulness, I got a strong self. I do not want to be coerced into anything. So trying, like, I should be concentrating on the dishes, you know, like it just, I don't know. It doesn't work, but somehow this gradual conversion of myself to, you know, can I be grateful for each thing that's happening? And it seems like the gratitude just naturally makes you pay attention, right? If you're grateful for something or the opportunity to do something or whatever, you pay attention to it instead of like, it's just something you've got to get through in order to get to something else. That's where a lot of my lack of mindfulness comes from, right? I'd rather be like doing this project or something rather than paying attention to what's in front of me. So we got a couple minutes. Janice, do you want to say something?
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for having me. Yeah. So I don't know if it's okay to bring in other schools of thought, but what it really makes me think of and what I've been sort of concentrating on is in Taoism is the concept of Wu Wei, right? Wu Wei is, you know, you're so immersed in the flow that you're noticing everything and not distracted by what's outside of the flow. If that makes sense. So it's almost, at least for me, it's almost easier to notice when I'm resisting a transition, right? When I'm blocking something. But it seems to me, and I don't know, but it almost seems as though Wei is kind of a flip side to mindfulness. Dunno. Okay, I'm done.
I don't know if it's a flip side or just another, like I said, another way of getting at the similar thing, perhaps. Because, you know, like I came up with the thought of like undivided and then like Tyler was talking about Shikan just this and I don't know, maybe. Well, we're at 8:59. It all goes so quick. Hopefully, I don't know. I feel like we didn't get to really go deeply into anything. I feel like this foundational teaching series should be twice as long. But there you are. You got a little overview of traditional mindfulness, little chance to explore how we do it in Zen. There's so much more to it. But yes, basically it's paying close attention to your life. Because your life is what you learn from. So we don't really need a whole list of like artificial teachings as long as we pay close attention to our own experience. All right, I will close with a verse. We dedicate the merit of our Sangha practice together to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you, Damiel.
Welcome.
Thank good night, you. All.
Good night.
Thank you.
Night. Thank you. Bye. Sweet dreams.
You too.